Thank you. The next case on our oral argument calendar this morning is in the matter of the appointment of the trustee of the next of kin of Dante Wright. Counsel, each of you will have 15 minutes for your argument with an additional 5 minutes for appellant's counsel if you'd like to use that time for rebuttal. We have had a little bit of glitchiness in our technology today, so I'll just alert you that to be mindful of that. If you see that you're having a difficult time seeing anyone or hearing anyone on the panel or your opposing counsel, please just somehow notify us and we'll try to pause the proceeding and let the technology catch back up to us. Also, even though we can see each other's faces and we can see everyone's name, we are only making, as we always do, only an audio recording of today's proceeding. So with that in mind, please do follow our regular guideline to state your name as you commence each leg of your argument so we can keep track of the argument for the sake of the recording. And Mr. Bradford, make sure you get your ticket punched for the frequent flyer miles that you get for making multiple arguments today for the, to the same panel.
Will do.
With that, counsel for appellant, whenever you are ready to proceed, you have the floor.
Thank you, Judge Ross, and may it please the court. My name is Mark Bradford. I represent the appellant, China Whitaker. Ms. Whitaker is the natural mother of Dante Wright Jr. The district court precluded Ms. Whitaker from participating as trustee on behalf of her son in a wrongful death action arising out of the tragic death of that child's father. The net result of the district court's decision is that Dante Wright Jr.'s interests in the wrongful death lawsuit will be represented by a legal team that Ms. Whitaker terminated for cause.
Just to be clear, your client's challenge wasn't to the trustee, but to a secondary service provider that the trustee might not necessarily retain.
Well, the trustee has retained the Ben Crump law firm.
I should say maintain. There's no requirement. Help me to understand what the district court decision was. Was the district court presented with other alternatives than a co-trustee? For example, was the district court presented with an option to have someone other than the appointed trustee?
Yes, my client, Ms. Whitaker. And there were actually two options presented. One was to have Ms. Whitaker appointed simply as trustee of her son, and the other was to have Ms. Whitaker participate as co-trustee with Ms. Bravin on behalf of all of the next of kin.
Right. So I guess my difficulty is, it seems like your argument is that there was a conflict of interest that your client was trying to provide some relief of by having a co-trustee arrangement. But if there was a conflict of interest, then because there's some fiduciary duty of the trustee to all the beneficiaries, it seems to me that offering herself up as the exclusive trustee creates the same problem that she's saying the district court allowed in not having a co-trustee.
Well, the problem, Your Honor, is the other beneficiaries on the parent's side of the family are certainly entitled to have whatever counsel they choose represent their interests in the litigation. The issue here is who should represent Dante Wright Jr.'s interests in the litigation, which is why we proposed having two trustees appointed, one for his interests, which are separate from the Crump law firm's representation of the family. And that leads me to sort of what was going to be my third part in the point in the argument, but I'll get to it now. Is, you know, my friend on the other side has taken the position that Ms. Whitaker somehow disqualified herself by seeking appointment only as trustee for her son. That argument is not supported by law, with all respect. There is nothing in the statute, 573.02, or case law interpreting that statute that says the district court cannot appoint one trustee for one group's interests and another trustee for a different group. The case law that has been cited by respondent is Boddicker, which is this court's decision in 2003, and Coles, K-O-L-L-E-S, which is a decision from 1988. Both of those cases involve trustees who were appointed to represent all of the next of kin. And in those cases, the trustees themselves were beneficiaries. and they made a settlement for the exclusive benefit of themselves. And in both cases, the court said, look, when you're appointed to represent everybody, you can't make a settlement for yourself. That is a far cry from saying the district court doesn't have authority to appoint multiple trustees. Which
Counsel, Judge Larkin, I have a few questions for you, if
yes.
I may. First, can you clarify, given your answers to Judge Ross's questions, that here today in this appeal, what you're challenging is the district court's refusal to appoint your client as co-trustee? You're not arguing that she should be appointed the sole trustee, correct?
That's correct, Your Honor.
And we reviewed the district court's decision not to appoint her as co-trustee for an abuse of discretion, correct?
Yes, Your Honor. And I'd be the first to admit that.
And as I understand the state of the law, there is nothing that says the district court cannot appoint co-trustees. There is case law indicating that the district court has done so in some circumstances, but I'm not aware of a statute or a rule or case law saying here are the things the district court must consider before it appoints co-trustee. Am I correct on that? There's no substantive law telling us what governs this decision.
Well, the governing law, Your Honor, is the statute itself, which has the components of a trustee being suitable and competent, and obviously.
But that in those requirements apply to whether or not someone can serve in a trustee capacity. Are there any separate guidance for the district court in determining whether there should be co-trustees instead of one trustee, as opposed to whether or not the proposed trustee is qualified to serve?
The direct answer to your question is no, but
okay.
Go ahead, Your Honor. I see you have a follow-up.
So then my question becomes, you know, how do we assess this for an abuse of discretion? Normally, when I look at a discretionary ruling and I want to decide whether or not the district court has abused its discretion, I say, well, what was the decision to be made? What was the law to apply to that decision? Did the district court apply that law? Did it apply that law correctly? And so I'm coming to the conclusion here that we don't have that law to look to here. In other words, when the district court was called upon to make this decision, there was no established substantive law that told the district court how it was supposed to make that decision. Is that a fair statement?
Well, Your Honor, I would only disagree to the extent that the statute itself provides the qualifications to serve as trustee. I would further answer the question this way. Ms. Whitaker provided the court sound reasons why a co-trustee was warranted in this case. She had very legitimate, unrebutted allegations of attorney misconduct, okay?
Is there any law that says that's, for that reason, a district court must appoint a co-trustee?
Well, but, and Your Honor, that my second point was going to be, the rationale that the court employed for refusing the request as co-trustee is not supported in the record. It would be one thing.
I ask this? I understand your position is the district court cited a potential conflict between your client and the members of Mr. Wright's family, and you're saying there's no evidence of such conflict.
Animosity is how she phrased it.
Animosity. Yet, opposing counsel points out in his brief that counsel for the proposed co-trustee at the hearing said to the district court, yes, there's animosity between my client and the family. I mean, so if in fact that was the representation that appellant's counsel made at trial, are we to fault the district court for hearing that representation and accepting it?
Well, no, because Your Honor, the premise of the question, with all respect, is that there was an admission of animosity between my client, Ms. Whitaker, and Dante Wright's parents. The question that was directed to counsel had to do with a conflict where one party on one side of the family has every reason to want to substantiate its claims more than the other. And on the other side, they want to substantiate their claims more than the other. That's different from the type of animosity that the court used to deny my client a co-trusteeship. Animosity is, I can't get along with you. And there's no evidence in the record, because that's what the district court said. There's animosity, which would make a co-trusteeship unworkable. And there's simply no evidence in the record of animosity. There's no declaration for anyone saying you can't get along.
Let's say we were to conclude, okay, the district court was wrong. There's really no animosity here. They could get along. The district court also said that a single trustee would be more efficient. What is wrong with that reasoning?
So, Your Honor, we have the 573.02 has been in existence for 110 years. We have had co-trusteeships appointed regularly. There is no case that has been brought forth at any point during that time where the parties had the co-trustees had a quote unquote stalemate. It is a concern that is supported by nothing in the record. And quite frankly, Your Honor, if there was a concern about animosity between the two factions of the family, that, in my view, only supports the notion of why two co-trustees are necessary, one to represent one side of the family and one to represent the other.
Let me ask you this. I mean, my concern is your argument seems to come from a position of like assuming the district court erred, assuming that the district court needs to appoint co-trustees unless the district court can justify not doing so. But I have a hard time with that proposition when we don't have any substantive law talking about when and why to appoint a co-trustee. So it seems to me the district court has significant discretion. And I don't think it's a matter of, well, the district court didn't cite a case saying this is a reason why I'm not appointing a co-trustee. Instead, the burden seems to be on appellant to cite us to something that says the district court did err in not appointing a co-trustee. Because we don't assume error on appeal, especially when it's abuse of discretion. And again, I come back to, and when there's no substantive law to look to by which we could judge the district court's reasoning, we're just sort of looking at the reasoning and saying, well, is this against logic and the facts and the record? And we have a case that's going to be complicated. A lot of decisions are going to be made. The district court thought it best to have one person at the helm that represents everyone. I'm having a hard time understanding how we would say that's an abuse of discretion without some law to back it up.
Sure. So a couple points, Your Honor. Number one is Ms. Whitaker did come forward with a rational, logical explanation for why two co-trustees were needed on the case because of this conflict. She had fired the lawyer that the new trustee proposed to represent her son. The district court never acknowledged that. Then we have the rationale that the court actually gave for denying the co-trustee status. So the court basically assumed, yes, I can appoint two trustees, and here is why I am not doing it. And our point simply is the reason why the court decided not to appoint a co-trustee is not supported in the record. We agree that the court has wide discretion.
What about the other reason, though, that the district court gave? Efficiency.
The predicate to that, Your Honor, it's not two separate rationales. The predicate to the efficiency conclusion is these parties have animosity, so they can't get along. Therefore, it's efficient to have one trustee. And that's our point, is the predicate to that finding of actual animosity is not supported in the record. The other thing I want to point out.
I'm going to assume you're correct that there's no support for animosity and that the real reason that your client offered a co-trustee relationship is the concern that the appointed trustee was engaging a lawyer who wasn't attentive to the general fiduciary duty to all the beneficiaries, but would somehow be biased in favor of some next of kin and not others. It seems like what your client is really asserting is that there's a risk of a breach of a fiduciary duty. And if I'm right about that, isn't there already a remedy for it? I mean, how is your client prejudiced when the district court is necessarily going to be involved in any distribution? Your client can raise any concerns about an actual breach of fiduciary duty, and the court can intervene. So even if you're correct that maybe it would have been best to appoint a co-trustee, how is your client prejudiced? Why would we reverse?
So, Your Honor, and that's the argument that was made in the respondent's brief, which is you can show up at the distribution hearing, and if you think your, you know, your client got the short end of the stick, you can object then. Appointment of a trustee, it involves far more than the amount of the monetary settlement. It includes who to sue, where to sue, what to sue them for, and how to hold them accountable. Those are all things that reasonably Ms. Whitaker, as a mother of her child, should be involved in as trustee, particularly under the circumstances here. This is a unique case where the lawyer who is now representing the interests of Dante Wright Jr. has been fired by the client. That is a very unique set of circumstances that are reflected nowhere in the district court's decision below.
It's let me, counsel, on that point, what in the record tells us that the appointed trustee, whom no one is challenging, is not going to make decisions that consider the best interests of the child and his interests in this litigation?
Well, with all respect, Your Honor, the most glaring one is the decision to retain lawyers that Ms. Whitaker fired for cause.
But I mean, the problem with that is you're on one hand saying, well, we don't have any problem with the trustee who has been appointed. But on the other hand, saying, well, that's not good enough because that trustee has made a wrongheaded decision about retaining this law firm.
We have, and I'm out of time. May I answer that, Your Honor? We have no issue with Ms. Brabbitt serving as the trustee for Dante Wright Sr.'s side of the family. The issue is, does our client have to have her son's rights represented by a lawyer that she's terminated? That screams out for appointment of a co-trustee.
And if I could just, I know your time has expired, but I'll take the privilege of the presiding judge to pose another question to you. I mean, this is not an unsophisticated trustee that we're talking about. We're talking about someone, as I understand it, with a significant legal background in the issue and who would presumably, even if the lawyer isn't as attentive to the general fiduciary duties to all of the beneficiaries, certainly the trustee would be aware. And it seems to me like as we assess whether there's an abuse of discretion, wouldn't we assume that the judge recognized that the trustee is going to be making the decisions, not the lawyer? And this is a sophisticated trustee making the decisions.
I agree that Ms. Brabbitt is qualified, and we don't challenge her qualifications to serve as the trustee for the other side of the family. But that insulation isn't enough when you have lawyers who are going to be taking compensation for representing Dante Wright Jr.'s interests in a matter in which they've already been fired. That is the circumstance that we have here, and that's what we're primarily concerned about.
Thank you, Mr. Bradford. You will have an additional five
Thank
minutes.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Judge Ross, if I may ask the indulgence of the presiding judge for just a couple of brief clarifying questions.
Please do.
Mr. Bradford, I'm trying to figure out from your brief, I know you cite the standard review as abuse of discretion, but it seems that you also, by characterizing this verbal comment that the court makes, transcript page 21, quote, I think that the conflict of attention or animosity between the family and Ms. Whitaker would make a co-trusteeship unworkable. You characterize that comment as a finding of fact, and then move on to argue that the evidence in the record is insufficient to support that finding of fact. So my question for you is whether or not we are reviewing that comment under a clearly erroneous standard of review.
So my understanding, Your Honor, is that the clearly erroneous standard of review would apply after some type of evidentiary hearing. This was not. What the court did is rule basically on the submissions, the written submissions. And I think the case law that we've cited is quite clear. I think both parties agree that it's an abuse of discretion standard. However, I will say, even if a clearly erroneous standard applied, the court would look to whether there's a record support for it. Clear error standard, pardon me.
So you're making a distinction between findings of fact that occur after an evidentiary hearing and findings of fact that occur in the absence of one, when factual findings are required to make the decision either way?
Well, what I'm saying, Your Honor, is I think it really doesn't matter whether it's clear error or abuse.
Let me stop you. It matters to us, I think, to know what our standard of review should be. So My question is simply, are we applying clearly erroneous standard to the thing that you've now characterized as a fact finding? Actual animosity would be a fact question. Are we applying clear error or not?
Pardon me, Your Honor, I misunderstood your question. I believe that is a fact finding, a fact that the court found. I mean, that is the predicate factual finding for the court's legal conclusion. So I do agree that with respect to that singular finding, a clearly erroneous standard would apply. And it is, in my view, clear error because it's not supported by the record. Pardon me, Your Honor, I misunderstood your question.
Well, looks like no further questions from the panel.
And I would like to apologize for the doorbell. It is that time of year and Amazon was dropping something off. So pardon me on that.
Thank you. Counsel for respondent.
Thank you, Your Honor. Jeffrey Storms on behalf of the respondents. I'm accompanied today by respondent Lisa Brabbit. And it was important for Mr. Wright and Ms. Bryant for me to express to the court that they would have liked to have been here. They are presently at the manslaughter trial of Kimberly Potter, and I believe Ms. Bryant may be testifying right now. And they asked that I express that. Your Honors, based upon the argument that I heard, I hope to keep myself very brief pending your questions, only because I tend to find that arguments amongst next of kin don't necessarily further the cause that we hope to accomplish here, which is to obtain the best result possible for all of Dante Wright's next of kin. With respect to appointing trustees for different sides of the family, it doesn't make sense. We pursue these matters all the time. We pursue them as federal section 1983 cases. Oftentimes we'll also include a supplemental state law claim. The Eighth Circuit is very clear that the trustee is the one with standing to pursue the claim. So there's under no circumstances is there a situation where Dante Jr. and one trustee pursues one form of litigation and another set of litigation is performed by a co-trustee. There is only one piece of litigation. A critical aspect that we pointed out that the court had recognized with respect to the efficiency aspect of its order is what do we do with a stalemate? And there's still no answer to that question, Your Honors. If there's a disagreement on what claims to pursue, what settlement to accept, how do the parties resolve that? Now, my friend Mr. Bradford pointed out that we've had cases before involving trustees, and that's certainly true. But there's no case I'm aware of where the court forced co-trustees upon the parties in a situation remotely similar to this. Are you
aware of any case that is remotely similar to this, where you have divided interests between the next of kin and the appointed trustee engages a lawyer who's been fired by one of the next of kin factions for excluding the beneficiary in various, I won't go over all the details, but in various ways as alleged and appears to be undisputed?
I'm not, Your Honor, and it's because the logic in this is somewhat odd. The question is about the appointment of a trustee, not the hiring of a lawyer. And here, appellant admits—
That's true, but we all know the force that a lawyer has on a client in a legal matter, even though you have a sophisticated trustee in this case who is the client, the lawyer is going to be the one who's advocating and advising certain courses of action, which may or may not involve circumstances where a conflict of interest might harm one faction of the beneficiaries. Is that not so?
Your Honor, I don't see where the potential for harm exists under these particular circumstances. First, we were transparent in the petition that the law firm that's alleged to be conflicted would be retained by the trustee. that gave notice to appellant. And so if appellant decided, we believe there is a conflict of interest, we believe that this lawyer should be disqualified from these proceedings in some fashion, the ability to make that argument to the district court existed. Instead, the argument was that that lawyer should be permitted to remain on the case. We should just all work together.
Does it still exist? Does the appellant still have an opportunity to raise an issue in the district court for the disqualification of the lawyer that is retained by the trustee?
So at any future proceeding, they certainly would, Your Honor.
So my question is, in a trust capacity, I mean, couldn't any of the parties whose interests are to be represented by the trustee bring an action at any point with the district court to say, I'm concerned the trustee is not representing our interests. We'd like the court to remove the trustee. We'd like the court to direct the actions of the trustee. I mean, doesn't the court oversee the actions of the trustee? And among those actions could be a decision about what lawyers to hire and retain?
Absolutely, Your Honor. You know, I think a clearest example would be a distribution proceeding, which when we go back to Judge Ross's question about protecting the interest of the minor child, our wrongful death statute is unique. You know, in other jurisdictions, you have different schemes. Here, we've established a number of checks and balances because of the types of recoveries that are permitted for all next of kin.
And counsel, let me ask another question on that point, because I know we've got the distribution hearing, but the other side seems to be saying, well, that's too late in the game. That doesn't address our concerns leading up to that point when we're trying to get to a distribution hearing. So I just want you to clarify for me, under the law, if any of the next of kin had concerns about decisions made by the single trustee, could those concerns be raised in the court and addressed in the court prior to the distribution hearing?
At any point of time, Your Honor, the trustee acts effectively as an officer of the court and is subject to the court. And so if someone believed the trustee was acting not in the best interest of any particular next of kin, at any point of time, they could come in and say this trustee needs to be removed. Or in theory, they could come back and ask for a co-trustee once again, if they thought that that made sense. But at any point in time, there is judicial supervision over the decision-making in this case.
Okay, so now I'm understanding your argument that this doesn't make any sense. Because if the argument is, well, the law firm should not be involved because it was fired by Ms. Whitaker, and that's the reason we need a co-trustee, why isn't Ms. Whitaker arguing to us that you know, the appointed trustee is not making good decisions and she shouldn't serve as trustee? I mean, it seems inconsistent to say, yes, we trust the appointed trustee to make good decisions, and yet at the same time be arguing that the law firm that the trustee has retained has a conflict and should not have been retained.
Absolutely, Your Honor. The only way this conceptually ever could have made sense to me is if, you know, a next of kin would have come in appellant's situation and said, Dean Brabbitt cannot be the trustee for X, Y, and Z reason. Somehow this disqualifies her from serving as the trustee, and instead our proposed trustee should serve as trustee. That would be a situation where you would say, okay, I understand what you're arguing with respect to the trustee. But here, when you come forward and say Dean Brabbitt's qualified to serve under the statute, what law is there, as Your Honor pointed out, that says that the court abused its discretion by not appointing a co-trustee? There's no standards for appointing a co-trustee. And we noted the plain language of the statute does not contemplate appointment of co-trustee. We certainly agree that the courts have the flexibility to, in their discretion, appoint co-trustees. And I've used co-trustees before, it's pointed out in the briefing, but those are situations where we recognize that the family is likely to work together and proceed in a harmonious fashion. And if at any point of time, the co-trustees do not work together in a harmonious fashion, then again, you have the court supervising that appointment. But here, yes, Your Honor.
Is there a procedural mechanism specifically that that would have allowed Ms. Whitaker to challenge the trustee's engagement of the particular challenged attorney? And is there going forward a procedural mechanism for her to do so?
So, Your Honor, the most obvious procedural mechanism would have been to challenge the trustee's appointments altogether. And the trustee was very candid. We were candid.
Assuming that everybody agrees that the trustee is otherwise well-suited.
Your Honor, I certainly am... I am certainly not interested in necessarily giving Mr. Bradford my procedural civil procedure analysis. However, what I will say more generally,
your analysis might help us to assess the question of prejudice. So maybe it's in your client's best interest to go ahead and answer.
Certainly, Your Honor. And what I'll say is this is, you know, what happens when we do these wrongful death cases, if there is a next of kin who didn't receive a trustee appointment and isn't happy with the way things are going on, what you often might see is some form of intervention in the action. And so hypothetically, let's say we're in federal court and the 1983 case is in suit, you might see Ms. Whitaker attempt to intervene in that case. And at that point in time, does that potentially create a conflict? That remains to be seen. You know, whether or not conflict issues arise there with herself and the attorney. The court really does not have a record to assess whether or not a conflict has ever arisen.
Well, because I was being more specific as to the maintaining of this particular attorney. So I'm wondering if you believe there was a procedure or could be a procedure in the future as it regards potential prejudice or lack of prejudice for Ms. Whitaker to both concede the appointment of a sole trustee and challenge the retention, ongoing retention of this particular attorney on conflict of interest or other grounds.
Yes, Your Honor. I believe there, certainly an option would have been if they thought the conflict was presenting itself at the trial court to seek to disqualify this individual attorney. Now, this individual attorney did not appear on the record in that matter. So there would obviously be some debate over whether or not there's actually a conflict in that proceeding. But then once we put the case into suit, whatever that court is pending in, if appellant believes there is grounds to disqualify an attorney from that litigation, you know, appellate can employ whatever procedural mechanism they think is appropriate, whether it's intervention or something else, to attempt to disqualify that attorney. But there's nothing to suggest that any concerns about an attorney are automatically imputed upon a trustee who appellant concedes is qualified to represent the interest of next of kin.
Mr. Storms, this is Judge Brown. I'd like to switch gears, although I did notice, Judge Larkin, you just raised your hand. I was going to switch gears a bit. So if you want to follow up, I'll cede the floor.
Just quickly, I mean, precisely what will Mr. Crump's role be in the federal litigation? He's just going to pursue the financial relief on behalf of the family. Is he going to be involved in the decision about how that award is distributed amongst the next of kin?
We have no intent for that to happen, Your Honor. Mr. Crump's sole role, and as we discussed in our briefing, is aligned with the interest of Dante Jr., which is to get the best result possible for all next of kin. And there's no reason to believe that that would not be his goal. And, you know, he did not appear at the trustee hearing, and I would not anticipate that he would ever appear at a distribution hearing on this matter under these
circumstances. So it seems there's a bit of a disconnect because Ms. Whitaker is concerned, appropriately so, that Mr. Crump had said, well, there's going to be a 50-50 split right off the bat before we look at the specifics. And that seems to be her concern, and it's a reasonable concern. But on the other hand, I'm not hearing that Mr. Crump is going to be dealing with that issue. Mr. Crump is trying to get the most money he can for everybody, and then somebody else needs to make a decision about how to distribute it and whether it's 50-50 will not be up to Mr. Crump, will it?
Not at all, Your Honor. It is up to Dean Brabbitt, ultimately. It would be her decision as a trustee, and there's no reason to suggest that she doesn't understand her fiduciary obligations or what traditional distributions look like in Minnesota under similar circumstances. And then from there, there's the added layer of protection of Judge Sullivan, if or for whatever reason, a different judge handles the distribution proceeding.
Understood. Thank you. Thank you, Judge Brian.
Sure. So I'd like to ask about what I see as the primary problem with the district court's decision. I didn't see any findings in the written order. And the only fact finding that I did see based on the party's briefs relates to the comment that I asked Mr. Bradford about. And that is characterized as a fact finding of actual animosity. And that was clearly erroneous in appellant's brief. In response, the only evidence that I saw that you directed our attention to is a comment by the attorney that uses the word conflict, not animosity, but conflict. And so, my first question for you is: do you agree that I'm seeing this in the right way? That there's a challenge to a fact finding.
Your Honor, I believe that in a summary proceeding such as this, I don't know that it necessarily has to be characterized as a fact finding, but I believe to the extent it is, it does support the district court's conclusion.
You know, right, so that's let me interrupt because that you're anticipating the next question. So first off, if you agree that there is a challenged factual finding regarding actual animosity. In your brief, the only support that you provided was an attorney's argument. And as you know, that's not evidence. Unless the attorney at the time was testifying as a fact witness, that wouldn't be evidence. So I was going to ask you, what evidence is there in the record? Not attorney argument about whether this admission using the word conflict is actually an admission of actual animosity that is disputed, but specifically what evidence in the record, putting aside the attorney's comments and putting aside the attorney's argument, evidence of actual animosity?
Your Honor, the entirety of the filings, the affidavits and the declarations in support reflect the tenor of animosity amongst these individuals. And that was so obvious that both attorneys acknowledged its existence, one more so than the other. And so overall, if you look at the entirety of the sworn evidence, I don't know how anyone could ever read all of that information and not glean from it that there is animosity amongst the parties.
Your time's expired, but Judge Larkin, I believe, has a question. So,
thank you. And just following up, is the district court required to make findings of fact when making a decision on who to appoint as the trustee?
There is nothing suggesting that the district court is required to make findings of fact. It is a summary proceeding, and our standard has been an abuse of discretion.
And I'm thinking back to my limited days in probate court on the district court bench. Things in probate court happen very summarily, and then once in a while someone objects, and then there is a contested hearing, and then facts could be found. Is there a procedure in Minnesota statute governing appointment of a trustee in a wrongful death act, which allows an objecting party to request or demand some sort of evidentiary hearing where there can be, you know, the formalities of presentation of evidence and factual findings on the record?
You can always request it, but the rule itself makes clear that the district court is provided vast discretion in how it conducts these proceedings. Judges across Minnesota conduct them very differently. But certainly, if appellant thought there was a need for findings of fact, we have procedural mechanisms to have requested that after the fact before this appeal is taken.
Okay, so we have no requirement for findings of fact and no sort of post-ruling request for clarification or factual findings based on the affidavits.
Exactly. No requirement and no request.
Well, that's all I had. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. Mr. Bradford, any rebuttal?
Thank you, Your Honor. Just three quick points. I want to follow up on this discussion about potential options relating to Mr. Crump's appointment as counsel on behalf of all of the next of kin in this case. That may be the next step, but let me back up and talk about why Ms. Whitaker did what she did. She recognized that her son is not the only next of kin, and that her the decedent's family could have their own trustee with their own lawyers. So rather than inject sort of the nuclear option right off the bat, which is to say, get Crump completely out of this case, what she reasonably did is say, give my son his own trustee with his own counsel, and we can proceed accordingly. Mr. Crump can represent the other next of kin. He has no conflict with respect to them. The conflict is with respect to her son. So she proposed a solution that would allow Ms. Brabbitt to stay in the case, would allow Mr. Crump to stay in the case, and simply have her own trustee for her own son.
Well, then, counsel, how does that work going forward? If your client's concern, you know, reasonably so, is she's not comfortable with Mr. Crump based on statements he made earlier, that's fair. But she's not saying remove him from the case. So, so is she suggesting that Mr. Crump is going to partner up with another lawyer of her choosing, and then they're going to team this wrongful death action in federal court?
Right. And that's exactly what happened in the Hansen case. Is you had two factions of a family come together with their own lawyers, pursue one lawsuit, and they did it successfully to verdict. That's exactly right. And
it seems to me that would take a whole lot of cooperation, because you need to get all the next kin in agreement. You need to put together two lawyers who may not want to be together to get there. I mean, I'm having a hard time seeing why it's wrong for the district court to say, no, we're not going to go down that path. We're going to have one trustee with one lawyer. That trustee can pick the lawyer who represents the interests of all the next of kin to try to obtain the best financial result possible. But what you're literally proposing, then, I want to make sure I'm clear, is we're going to have co-trustees, and then each trustee will have its own legal representation in prosecution of the wrongful death suit.
That's correct, Your Honor. And the district court, there weren't any findings.
Well, how does that, though, and I assume, though, that the lawyers all get paid, so now we have two lawyers drawing from the proceeds of the wrongful death suit, or do they get attorney fees in federal court?
There are attorney fees, but the way it would work, Your Honor, is whatever contractual relationship the co-trustee, in this case, Ms. Whitaker, would have with her own lawyers, those lawyers would get paid pursuant to that contract.
Okay. So from her.
Its parents would have a contract with their lawyers. Let me just make two more points, if it's okay with the court. The notion that animosity can be gleaned sort of from the record as a whole, I really do think that's a circular argument, because all it says is the fact that she objected is reflective of animosity. And I believe her objection is reasonable based on the fact that the trustee intended to hire the law firm that she terminated.
Mr. Bradford, it seemed to me that Mr. Storms was making a much bigger comment, not the fact of objecting as evidence of animosity, but saying that everything about the case shows animosity. Would you be willing to respond to that?
Sure. The record certainly reflects animosity between Ms. Whitaker and Mr. Crump. There's no disputing that, and that's the whole point of the cross petition. The point here is there's no animosity in the record between Ms. Whitaker and Dante Wright's parents, which was the reason for the district court concluding that a co-trusteeship is unworkable. That evidence is not in the record. One thing I do want to point out, I only have a few seconds left, is the timing of all of this. So, and I appreciate this didn't get the attention it deserved in the briefing, but Ms. Whitaker terminated the Crump firm on April 15, which is a Wednesday. The petition for appointment of Ms. Brabbitt as trustee was then filed the following Monday, 5 days later. So the lawyers that had been terminated, Mr. Crump, filed his petition right after being terminated, it has all the hallmarks of an attorney race to the courthouse. And I think that further supports why co-trusteeship is warranted and necessary in this case. Appreciate it.
Well, I'm going to stretch you beyond your time. Okay. You have another question for you. So I gather from the preamble to your rebuttal argument that your client chose not to use, I don't know if you used the nuclear option, you chose not to target Attorney Crum, but simply to say, well, fine, if he sticks around, we've got a different remedy to the conflict that you're suggesting exists. Well, in light of the fact that the district court has chosen not to appoint a co-trustee, are you aware of any procedural bar to your client going forward if your client believes there's a sufficient basis to insist that the trustee choose a different lawyer, one who has no conflict your client?
To directly answer your question, Judge Ross, I am not aware of any bar that would preclude us from doing that. And if this court concludes that my client is stuck with the lawyer that she terminated, then that may very well be the next step.
Well, pause. We wouldn't be determining that your client is stuck with any lawyer, but the issue is whether your client, on appeal, whether your client should be a co-trustee or stuck with a different sole trustee. And a lawyer appointment is an entirely separate issue. Legally.
Well, to clarify, Your Honor, the petition for appointment as co-trustee also proposed who would represent the co-trustee, Mr. Bolt and Mr. Bowers. So if this court were to reverse and say a co-trustee is necessary under the facts of this case, we would have separate counsel. If the court were to affirm, the necessary corollary of that is this trustee, Ms. Brabbitt, remains in place for everyone, as does the Crump team's representation of everyone. So we would, in a sense, be stuck with Mr. Crump, and we'd have to address that.
So you're saying there's no procedural mechanism for you to raise a challenge to the
No, pardon me, Your Honor. I thought you asked me if I was aware of any bar to doing that. I'm not aware of any bar to doing that. We could make a motion on remand to preclude Mr. Crump from representing my client.
In light of that, and in light of the fact that the district court would presumably employ all of the standards of conflicts of interest and concerns that your client is raising about the child being left out, why doesn't that resolve the second question that we would have to answer in addressing your appeal, which is that there was an abuse of discretion and that it mattered, that it prejudiced your client?
Yeah, well, it did prejudice my client because as it stands right now, we are stuck with a lawyer that has been terminated for cause.
Right, the fact that you acknowledge that there's a procedural mechanism for you to challenge the trustee, doesn't that resolve the question of prejudice? How is your client prejudiced if there's a mechanism to deal with a more precise target concern that you've had?
And I think both lawyers answered this the same way in that there may be. I don't think either lawyer can point to anything that says there is or is not a mechanism below. I'm not aware of any bar to it, but I'm also not aware of any sort of affirmative statute or rule that would give us that relief.
But you could certainly bring a motion to remove the court-appointed trustee because she has made a decision that's a poor decision and not in the best interest of all the next of kin in retaining Mr. Crump.
Yes, if it rose to the level of a breach of fiduciary duty, I believe there is the capacity to do that. But again, you know, the whole point of this exercise was not to lob a grenade of that size. It was to come up with a workable solution under the statute to have both parties represented by trustees of their choosing.
And we've taken this quite a bit longer than the time, but because we can, we will. So
let me ask you. I think we're the last argument, right?
It is the last oral argument. I will tell you that, just to put all the cards on the table, appealing to me is Mr. Storm's argument that in the end, the lawyer who is in Mr. Crump's position, or whoever that lawyer ends up to be, is pursuing claims on behalf of all of the next of kin, yeah, and is not involved in the distribution decision. And any conflict of interest, it seems, would not have, well, wouldn't reflect itself in a way that harms your client in any way.
Yeah, so I will address that, Judge Ross. If there hadn't been a prior termination of counsel, I would agree that the only way that we could remove Mr. Crump from the representation of our client is if a conflict actually manifested itself. But where you have one party that has terminated the other for cause, and the attorney for cause, and now that attorney is sort of backdoored his way into now representing that client, I don't think the client has to wait for it.
No, that's not my question. My question is, why does it matter? I mean, if Mr. Crump thinks that your client is a really bad person and isn't concerned at all about how much money your client makes, but is really concerned about how much all of the other beneficiaries earn, and is therefore zealously representing the interest of the entire beneficiary class, then your client is in the same shoes.
Right.
I mean, you're not challenging the qualification of the lawyer. You're not challenging the quality of the lawyer, the ability to litigate a case as well as anyone else. So I'm at a loss for how your client could possibly be any worse off in the with the outcome if
so
Mr. Crump litigates effectively.
Yeah, and I apologize for the impasse here, Judge, but that the problem that I'm seeing in the question is where you have a client that has terminated a lawyer. You know, what I'm gathering from the court's question is if that lawyer is now representing that client after termination, sort of no harm, no foul, the problem is the client has terminated the attorney-client relationship. So we don't have to establish that the lawyer is going to do something bad. All we have to establish is we've terminated him. How can you have a lawyer?
My question was focused on distribution.
Yeah.
If there's no effect in the distribution.
But we don't know that. I mean, I take Mr. Storm's word, but we don't know that.
Judge Ross?
Morgan has a question.
Yeah. And I guess, and again, that's just, I don't have familiarity in this area, but isn't the lawyer, is the lawyer representing the next of kin or representing the trustee technically?
The lawyer is hired by the trustee to okay. represent.
So isn't the attorney-client relationship between the lawyer and the trustee? I mean,
I think it, pardon me, Your Honor, I didn't mean to interrupt you.
Isn't it?
Well, so the
trustee. I mean, in other words, is the trustee going to be communicating with Mr. Crump and making all the decisions regarding trial strategy, settlement, et cetera? Or do we envision a situation where all of the next of kin are going to be having individual conversations with whichever lawyer is retained and providing direction to the lawyer as to what he's supposed to do in the case?
Well, in every wrongful death matter that I've been involved in, Your Honor, it is a global discussion with the trustee and with the next of kin in terms of settling a lawsuit.
Okay. And then the trustee communicates with the lawyer who's representing the trustee.
Typically, the lawyer will be communicating with the trustee and the next of kin.
Okay. So why is there any problem here? I mean, for two reasons. First, it sounds like the trustee is willing to work with all the next of kin and that there's no accusation that the trustee who's been appointed is not willing to work with Ms. Whitaker and take her views into account. And Mr. Crump is going to be prosecuting the wrongful death action and not necessarily involved in the distribution. And if he is, he could be challenged at that point, or the appointed trustee could be challenged. I'm just having a hard time understanding why legally Mr. Crump's involvement is a problem, unless you show that it's a problem that reflects on the judgment of the trustee who is appointed to represent the interests of the next of kin. I appreciate that Ms. Whitaker is not happy with Mr. Crump. Right. I understand why she feels, I don't want him involved in my son's lawsuit. I don't want someone who said these things to me having his hands in this. But that's not how we're going to decide the case, if we even get to this conflict of interest issue, because I'm not sure that it's, you know, should be a basis for a decision here in the first place. when we have no substantive law governing the judge's decision whether or not to appoint co-trustees?
Let me see if I can answer
the far down the road here.
Let me see if I can answer the court's first question, which is, you know, why this matters. And I appreciate we're to respond to that, Your Honor. I'm going to have to go outside of the record and sort of pose some questions of my own. But in this relationship, and it is sort of the tripartite relationship, you have the trustee hiring the lawyer to represent the next of kin. How is that lawyer? Pardon me, my lights just went out. How is that lawyer compensated? He's compensated based on the recovery of a particular next of kin. And so you have Mr. Crump now, who would conceivably be entitled to, and I haven't seen the contract, so again, I'm arguing outside the record here, some percentage of the recovery of Dante Wright Jr.'s claim in a matter in which he's been terminated previously as Mr. Wright's counsel. That's part of the problem here.
No additional questions for me.
All right. Thank you, Your Honors. Thank you for your briefing. Thank you for your oral argument. Thank you for your willingness to keep you both beyond your traditional time limits so we can explore more of these interesting legal questions. We appreciate your arguments, both in writing and today, and we take the matter under advisement.